Thanks for that introduction. Now I've got to live up to it, right? We'll see if we can do that. I've also got more slides here than what I can handle, so we'll see how far we can get. This morning I'd like to deal with an issue. It may not be a problem for you, but it is a huge problem, I think, for the church in general. And the issue and the question is, what about those who have never heard the gospel? What about those that are in isolated areas in the world that have not heard a missionary or seen a Bible or in any way have had contact with what the New Testament teaches concerning Jesus Christ? And if they have not heard the gospel and Christ is the only way, well, a lot of Christians try to kind of smooth over that and say, well, there must be another way for some of these people. So I'd like to answer that. And if it's not an issue for you, I know you'll encounter people that struggle with this, and hopefully you can give them an answer. Now, this passage that I'd like to look at, 18 through 23, and actually goes to the end of the chapter, is packed full. In fact, I'm in the process of teaching the book of Romans, and it took me, I think, 6 or 7 weeks to get through this passage. So there's a lot there. I'm going to try and summarize it and give you the high points of it, and particularly focus in on answering this question. And to give you a little background, the book of Romans was written to believers in the city of Rome, and Paul, on his third missionary journey, had planned, in fact, he mentions in his introduction to the book of Romans that he had had several plans to visit the churches, and there were several of them in the city of Rome, and he desired to visit, but as he's coming close to the end of his third missionary journey, he realizes that he's not going to make it to Rome. So he does the second best thing, he sends them a letter. Now, I think all of this is orchestrated by the Holy Spirit, knowing that if Paul writes this letter, he's going to inspire the writing, and also knowing that this would be useful for the church down the road. I think Paul, had he gone to Rome, he would have presented verbally and in person the content of what we have in the book of Romans. So I think in the providence of God, God delayed him such that now we have this book. And I'm going to begin at the beginning of the doctrinal section that begins to give us kind of a foundation for everything else that we'll have in the book. So I only show these to emphasize, and I know this is not an issue for you, but when Paul writes, he's writing to real people that had real issues, real concerns. They lived in time. They lived in a particular location. Paul had his own life and issues in his experience. So these are real things. And just to emphasize that, Paul would have seen some of the structures that we looked at. Three structures there. Temple of Vespasian off to the right, almost most of it off the slide. The center there at the bottom is the arch, Severus, and then the Temple of Saturn. Now, all of these date back. The arch would have been after the time of Paul, but Paul would have seen the other temples because they were built in the time before Christ himself. Just a couple of visuals to kind of get you into the city of Rome, and all of the believers would have been familiar with these sites, and Paul visited there later on as well. Another arch was built in the first century, not there when Paul was there, because it commemorates the destruction by the Romans under Titus of the city of Jerusalem and the temple, and essentially the destruction of the entire nation. And there's a relief on the side there that commemorates that and shows some Jewish scenes. And if you visit Rome, you can take a look at that. Just more on the context and the setting. Paul gives an extended introduction, and it's got two parts. Actually, you could say three parts. He gives a formal introduction, much like some of his other books, and then he gives more of a personal or informal introduction where he talks about his desire to be with the Romans and a desire to visit, etc., and some other personal issues. And then he gives an outline of everything that he's going to cover in verses 16 and 17. You might say a thematic introduction to the book. And then he begins in verse 18, the body that I think extends all the way at least to the end of chapter 8. If not, some commentators extend it all the way to the end of chapter 11. That would be his doctrinal section. So this is the essence of Paul's theology, the essence of what Paul would have taught, and probably the essence of what he did teach in several locations where he founded churches. So this is the heart of Pauline theology, Pauline thinking, Pauline doctrine. And the main thing that he's mentioning here, he lays out that God has provided this righteousness. So he's got to define it and explain it. What is righteousness? And he does some of that in the text. I won't get into a lot of the detail of that, but as you work your way through, and by the way, the word righteousness occurs 66 times in the book of Romans. That's the key word. God has provided righteousness for lost humanity. And that runs at least to the end of chapter 8. Now, he'll deal with Israel in 9, 10, and 11, relating also to righteousness. But before anyone is ready to receive this righteousness, they must know that they have a desperate need. And when you're sharing the gospel, this is the starting point. We need to convince people that they have a need for God's righteousness or a relationship with Him, a standing before Him. Righteousness is a right standing before God, but we all stand condemned, and that is going to run all the way through the middle of chapter 3. So this is a large portion of the book of Romans to convince the reader. Now, he's writing to Christians. He's not writing to the unbeliever. This is not an evangelistic book. This is a book to prepare and to give believers a biblical foundation to be able to share with the unbeliever. So he's got to lay out theologically, and he does this theologically using terms that an unbeliever would not be familiar with. But the bottom line is he ends by basically showing that mankind and all of humanity stand condemned before a holy God, a totally and ultimately righteous God. He is the standard, and everyone falls short of that. And then under that, he starts with the first part of that. There's actually three parts to this. The first one is chapter 1, beginning in verse 18, where he's going to show the guilt of all of humanity. And that's the portion that we're going to look at this morning and how it relates particularly to those that have perhaps never heard the gospel. There's several applications we can draw. We can also see that this is a description of humanity in general. We could even look at it more locally and look at it as a nation. And this is a description of a nation. And you could even give it a different title. You could call it the collapse of a culture or the collapse of a nation. And he lays down the steps in that. And we'll see some of that in the exposition here. So we're going to look at only a small portion of it, 18 through 23. But it's packed full, as you will see as we go through there. And what he's basically saying is that all of humanity has rejected that one true God. This is true of every human being. In fact, you might describe it in this broad sense in terms of humanity. Now, he's speaking, some commentators view it from the perspective of the Gentiles because he's going to be more specific when he gets to chapter 2 and focus in more on the religious culture or the religious mind, and probably applying it to the Jewish people. And there were Jewish Christians in the city of Rome, and they would have been able to identify with chapter 2 through part of chapter 3. But I think he's including all of humanity, and then he's going to be more specific when he gets to chapter 2. And the first thing that he starts off with, he doesn't start off with a positive message. He doesn't say, God loves you, and et cetera, et cetera. He starts off with a very drastic and harsh statement, but it is reality, and I'll get to that in verse 18. Let me give you a big picture of all of chapter 1, because we won't be able to get it into all of the verses, and in a chart, if you want a chart, you can put it in an outline form, and the outline kind of follows, or the chart follows my outline, if you've got an outline sheet there. But in broad strokes, he's going to say that all of mankind, man is under the wrath of God. Man is condemned and is facing a future of God's wrath. Now, he's going to say it in a peculiar way. In fact, even in a surprising way, he's going to put it in the present tense. And I'll comment a little bit on that in a moment. You can break beginning in verse 19 through verse 23. So we're going to focus on these first two parts, and I'll just briefly touch on the third one. But he's going to give the reasons for this wrath. And in giving the reasons, he's going to lay out even the person that has not heard the gospel, they are not exempt. They, in fact, are under the wrath of God. Is it hopeless? Well, in one sense it is, but in another sense, no, because God has done something. And he's going to talk about the reasons why this wrath is going to be and is, present tense, poured out. So verses 19 through 23, that'll be the focus. And then I'll just touch on verses 24 through 32. I call it the rendering of God's wrath, or the outpouring of that wrath. And it's in the present tense, and you can observe it today. You could have observed it in the first century. You could have observed it every time throughout church history. It's in the present tense. Now, yes, God poured out wrath in the past. Genesis flood, Sodom, Gomorrah, upon the nation of Israel, even in the New Testament, Ananias and Sapphira, etc., etc. Yes, God is going to pour out wrath in the future. There is a final judgment, but he's talking about present tense. God pours out wrath today, and you can see it. Now, if we had more time, we could look at that in verses 24, but I'm just going to skim over that because I'm going to give you another part of the passage. So we can break down verses 18 through 23. First of all, we have the revelation of the wrath and the reasons for God's wrath. That's 18 and 19. And it's one sentence. That's why I group it together, exegetically putting it in one bigger idea with two parts. Verse 18 focuses on the revelation of that wrath. And in fact, that's what it says. For the wrath of God is revealed, present tense. So he doesn't start off with a positive note. He lays out from the very beginning, and then he's going to build upon that, defend that, explain it, so that the believer understands the issue at stake in sharing the good news about Jesus Christ. But we need to understand the bad news, otherwise we don't appreciate and even understand the good news. So the wrath of God is revealed against men, all of humanity, very general, very broad, and I think all of humanity is involved. So what is this God's wrath? Well, it's not irrational state. God doesn't lose his temper. It's not a loss of control. All of a sudden he brings a Genesis flood. He lost it that day. That's not God's wrath. It's not a bad temper. Now, we think of these things because when we show anger or wrath, sometimes this is characteristic of us, and our wrath oftentimes is tainted by sin, but be careful not to associate God with all of those sinful aspects that we experience. So it's not a bad temper. It's not cruelty. In fact, it's deserved, and it's not vindictive rage. God is not trying to get even with mankind for violating his standards. That's not what God's wrath is, but God's wrath is God executing justice. God is a just God, and he implements that justice by one aspect of it, pouring out wrath. And it's justice against sin. And by the way, that's the message of the whole Bible from Genesis 3, the fall of man, all the way to the end. What is it? Well, it's a necessary reaction to evil because God is a holy God. He must deal with sin. In fact, if he does not deal with sin, then there'd be a flaw in God, and obviously there is not. It's also right. In other words, there's no evil involved in it. It's totally righteous. In other words, it meets his standards of righteousness. That's his wrath. It's indignation, for sure, or anger, but it's against injustice. And if we had more time, we could talk more about that. All of us yearn for justice. And part of justice is dealing with evil, dealing with sin. So God's wrath is necessary. And it's always judicial. In other words, it always deals with justice and righteousness. So it's always judicial. It's not out of control. It's not a bad temper, etc. It's always judicial. And it involves a punitive or a punishment aspect. It's punitive justice. God effecting righteousness. God correcting, you might say, evil and dealing with evil. Some theological statements, John Murray: wrath is the holy revulsion of God's being against that which is the contradiction of his holiness. So God must act in wrath. And this is where the book of Romans begins, at least the doctrinal portion. Another writer, C.K. Barrett: wrath is God's personal, though never malicious or in a bad sense emotional, reaction against sin. Both of those are very good descriptions of God's wrath. They're supported by Scripture. Now, if we had more time, in fact, in the exposition that I did for the church that I did this for, I spent a whole session on this whole topic itself. Just a few implications. This is God's attitude toward sin, so we need to keep that in mind, because we are sinners, and we, even as believers, fall short and, in fact, involved in sin. If you want to know the attitude that God has, this is his attitude towards even white lies, even little sins in our lives. This will also, if you understand God's wrath, and by the way, a lot of churches water it down, a lot of churches ignore it, a lot of churches avoid it. I think that's a huge mistake. And I think that's the reason Paul starts with it, because he doesn't want it to be overlooked. And if you deal with it biblically and from what God has revealed in his word, then it's going to give you an appreciation for his grace. So he starts with wrath before he gets to grace, because you can't understand grace unless you understand wrath. And you certainly can't appreciate it without an understanding. So it'll give us an appreciation, and it gives us a healthy, as a believer, fear for God. Because God is a God of wrath. Yes, he's a God of love, and the church overemphasizes that to the neglect of the other truth. God is a God of wrath as well. Wrath and justice and holiness, etc. So, for the wrath of God is, present tense, revealed from heaven. So it comes from the abode of God, and it's against all. Notice the universal language here. No one exempted, no matter where they live, no matter their background, no matter their culture, no matter their exposure to the gospel, against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men. He's going to work his way through all of chapter 1, chapter 2, part chapter 3 to explain that unrighteousness of men and that all are guilty before a holy God. So very broad. We could go into some detail there. And a detail that he includes who suppress the truth in unrighteousness. That's the tendency of the human heart. That's the tendency of lost humanity. That's the tendency of all of us, even as believers. It's not easy to study the word. It's hard to get into it. There's something in that old lost nature that suppresses the truth. And this is all that the unbeliever has. All he can do is suppress the truth, because the truth condemns him. Because the truth makes him aware that he has a need for God, and he, in fact, is rebellious against that God. So, who suppress the truth in unrighteousness. He uses a strong word here. If we had more time, I could go into more detail. Kat echo, to suppress, to hold firmly, or to keep something, and in this context, to hold it back, or to suppress it, or to detach it, deny it even, distort it. This is all the human heart. Depart from it, disobey it. All of these are descriptive words of the Greek word that is used there. If you want more support, if we had time, we could look all those up. We won't for now. By the way, I'm going to post what we're doing here on my website. Slight correction, forhisglorynm.com. Don't forget the NM. Okay. So what is suppression? Well, the unbeliever suppresses reality. Even though God has put within him a sense that there has to be more than what he is experiencing, he suppresses that and the reality of his guilt as well. He suppresses his conscience. In fact, you can sear a conscience. That sense of guilt is suppressed. We occupy our minds with other things because we don't want to face a holy God. We suppress our accountability to God. This is the unbeliever. The sense of judgment, we want to push that away. We want to suppress it. It manifests itself in a lot of ways in the culture. Our tendency is to avoid these truths. We suppress the concept and the idea of God. This is true of the unbeliever. He flees rapidly, fast, from anything spiritual, anything that's going to bring him account. We suppress the seriousness of sin and condemnation. We ignore it. We want to put it out of our thinking. When you're dealing with the unbeliever, all of this is going on in them. That's why it's so hard and so difficult to get somebody to listen to a gospel message. All of this is going on. And this is true of every human being. And you could illustrate it by children. You can see it. I could give you more clear examples, but I think all of you that have children or grandchildren, you see it. Even as an infant, what's one of the first words they learn? No. You've got the experience. We could talk about that some more. So verse 19 gives us the reason that God is bringing this wrath. It's not out of nowhere. God has a reason, and he lays them out very clearly. And because of the universal language here, it pertains to anyone, whether they are raised in a church or whether they're raised in, we used to say, the darkest of Africa, but there are more believers per capita in Africa today than there are in the United States. So we ought to say in the deepest and the darkest of America, right? So each of them, God has a reason for this wrath. That's verse 19. So 19 through 23, reasons for wrath. So we can start in verse 18. The wrath of God is revealed, and then he's going to give the reasons because, beginning verse 19, that, and this gets into kind of the support of the idea that I'm going to present concerning those that have never heard the gospel. Because that which is known about God is evident within them. There's a revelation that God has made. That's the stress of this passage. God has made sure that every person on the face of the earth has had a revelation of him. That's key. That's what this says. Because that which is known, and another thing I want you to notice, is the stress on the idea of knowing and comprehending, being aware. There's several words that I'm going to highlight as we go through here. The first one, that which is known. In other words, it's not a mystery. This is revealed. That which is known about God is evident with them. God has revealed it. It's evident and it's internal. Known about God. We have another Greek word here. Gnostos. It's a very common word. Knowledge. It's a noun form. There's a verb form as well. Gnostos, that word. There's a couple of words in the Greek text that refer to knowing. This one, in many contexts, it's knowing by experience. So it's a personal and a real knowledge. It's not just a theoretical knowledge. So all men are exposed to a knowledge, a personal knowledge of God. Something known, capable of being known, something intelligible. Miracles reveal something, and when people encounter them, they experience knowledge of God. That's the purpose of miracles. Spiritual truth can be conveyed, and these are just passages that illustrate that. Spiritual truth, you can't see it, you can't touch it, but you can know it. And you can even experience it. It can touch you. God himself, verse 19, that's the verse we're talking about. God can be known. Now, I teach the concept of the incomprehensibility of God. In fact, I spent another session talking about that. And what does the Bible mean about the incomprehensibility of God? And what the essence of it is that we cannot know anything about God in reality except through revelation. The incomprehensibility of God means that we cannot come to into a knowledge of God apart from revelation. This passage is giving us fundamental revelation. Now, God is incomprehensible, and every idea that we have of God is a distorted idea that comes from our surroundings, our world, our own thinking, but it's not a true knowledge of God because he's incomprehensible. I can give you several verses. That does not mean he's not knowable. God is knowable because he has made himself known and he's revealed himself. That's part of what we're dealing with here. And verse 19, God can be known. Not by science, not by psychology, not by our own thinking, but by revelation. That's the point here. So we have general revelation. Our tendency is to suppress that. We saw that in verse 18. Truth is knowable. Truth about God is knowable, verse 19. And it is evident. In other words, God has made it not only known, but evident. Here's another word that supports this idea. God involved in communicating to lost humanity. The word there is phaneros, something that is evident, something that is made known, something that's visible in some context, even in some context, something that is even obvious. God has made it known, made it evident. There's a couple of other verses that support those ideas. So we could say, when it's evident, it's clear. Every person on the face of the earth has had a clear revelation of God. And it's internal. It's within them. God has revealed himself internally. And part of the functioning of how we are built, God has built mankind with conscience. And conscience is designed to make God evident. In other words, we know intuitively, inwardly, through conscience, that there is a right and a wrong, and we know there's accountability, and we know that there is a God. So it is a revelation within. So it's an internal. If you want another passage that makes it crystal clear, he's dealing with the unbeliever in 2:14 and 15, and he's dealing with conscience. God has written within mankind his law, or at least some elements of it. Enough of that law to be accountable to God. I'll let you look up that for the sake of time. 2:14 to 15. That's that internal revelation. If that's not enough, God made it evident. Is God going to fail in revealing himself? God is the one that is doing it. We fail, but he's not. He is going to make sure that every person born on the face of the earth has a revelation of him. Okay? He uses the word twice. He uses the noun form. In fact, let me backtrack here. Evident, that's the noun form. For God made it evident, there's the verb form. So he uses it twice, lest you miss it the first time. So he uses phaneros, that's the noun. And then secondly here in the same passage, same context, use the verb to make known or to make evident or to manifest something. There are some other usages of the verb form in Colossians and in 1 Timothy. So it's understood. God made it understandable. God implanted it. And he put it inside. He put it internal. So that moves us to 20 and 21. That revelation is rejected. So God is revealed and that revelation is rejected. 20 and 21, those two verses go together, so I group them together. For, he's going to continue, in other words, what is another way that God has made his revelation known? For since the creation of the world, so it doesn't matter what time frame people have lived, since Adam and Eve, since the creation of the world, even before Adam and Eve, because God created the universe. And on day six, he creates mankind, Adam and Eve. And he says, since the creation of the world, so this revelation has been a continuous, ongoing revelation that has never stopped. As long as there has been a physical world, and the physical world has existed since the creation, this revelation has gone on. And notice his invisible attributes, things you can't see. His invisible attributes, his eternal power and divine nature have been, what does he emphasize again? Clearly seen. Nobody can miss it. All you have to do is look out at the universe and you see a revelation of God. In fact, God has designed the universe such that one of the purposes of the universe is to reveal himself. No matter where you look, you ought to be able to see the fingerprints of God. Because his creation reveals it. He's going to expand that at the end there. But his invisible, the portion there, his invisible attributes, and he specifies two of them, eternality and in terms of eternal power as well. His divine nature, they have been clearly seen. They are not hidden. Even if you're blind, you still have a sense. I'm going to give you an example of a blind person as well. So attributes have been seen, and you can observe them. The first one that should recognize and be able to testify is a person that studies the natural realm. What do we call them? Scientists. They should be the first one to recognize it. But it doesn't take a scientific mind. All you have to do is just observe, and you will see something of the nature of God. So it's a constant revelation. We're talking about general revelation. We're not talking about the Bible yet. We're talking about that God has put in the natural realm. Our tendency is to suppress it, but it's knowable, verse 19. It's clear, verse 19. It's internal, verse 19, and also 2, 14, and 15. It's understood, verse 19. God implants it. And verse 20, it's constant and ongoing, you could add. So general revelation involves the creation, and there's evidence of design. You can see that everywhere you go, from the microscopic all the way to the galactic. God has also revealed himself in a general way in acts that he's performed in history. So history testifies to God. That's general revelation. Also conscience that we just talked about, 2:14 to 15. You could even use Ecclesiastes 3:11. God has put eternity in man's hearts. That's Ecclesiastes. That's general revelation. Every human being can have some contact and experience with the natural realm. And if you study history or the past, you have some contact with what God has done. And if that's not enough, God has planted within every individual conscience, such that every individual is aware of standards and even God himself. So his attributes, eternal power. Let me give you just one vivid example of that power. The greatest, probably visible experience that we have with power, we could look at the omnipotent power of God as illustrated in the creation. Just looking at the sun, and I've got a lot of statistics here. I won't go over a lot of them. The diameter, 865 miles across, 109 times the size of the Earth. So this is a gigantic body out there. We look at it, we see it doesn't look that big, but it's huge, particularly in comparison to our little tiny planet that to us is huge. From Earth, it's 93 million miles away. It takes light 8 minutes and 20 seconds to get here. And if you know the speed of light, it's inconceivable, but yet it's finite, takes time. And yet, even though we can't conceive of the power contained within the sun, I could give you the numbers, but they're meaningless. But let me give you kind of a feel for it. And keep in mind, this is omnipotent power. Who created the sun? God himself. But think about it. How many suns are there in the Milky Way? We're familiar with one sun, and astrophysicists say that our sun is an average-sized, average star in the Milky Way. The estimates that scientists have is that, it orbits, another statistic there, 100 billion suns in the Milky Way. Is that an illustration of omnipotent power? The Creator, God, built all of those suns. His power is greater than 100 billion suns in the Milky Way. How many Milky Ways, how many galaxies do scientists estimate? And this is just what we observe that are visible. There's probably more even. Anyone have an idea? Same number, 100 billion galaxies. We can't even conceive of the power of one star. And there's 100 billion in our galaxy and 100 billion stars. Does that illustrate omnipotent power? God is greater than that. God's power. So you look out, you study astrophysics. What does Psalm 19:1 tell us? The heavens, what? Declare the glory of God. This is just one example of one body that's close to us. You can magnify that looking at all the other stars as well in the Milky Way and beyond that. That gives you a picture, so the heavens do declare. Now, the text also says it's not speaking English or verbally, but it's communicating truth, the truth of an omnipotent God. So we have omnipotent power. We can see it in many ways, and I've just got some illustrations here. I'm going to skip through this for the sake of time. Cataclysms on Earth, even on the atomic level, atomic forces, galaxies, I just illustrated that, displays historically, Genesis flood, etc. So, let's begin to summarize what this passage is telling us. The passage is making it crystal clear that God has adequately and clearly revealed himself. That revelation is by God himself, therefore it is clear. And man, the implication here is man has a knowledge of that, a realization. And I'm using realization because you'll see I'm going to alliterate here. So realization is going to go along with some of the other R's I have here. So in 1920, man realizes that there has to be a God. And in fact, we could even say there is no such thing as a real atheist. An atheist has so deceived himself and has convinced himself that there is no God. But this tells us every atheist deep down knows that there's a God. So when you share the gospel with an atheist, you don't need to tell him that he knows there's a God, but you need to realize that your gospel message may awaken something way deep down that he has suppressed. That's an example of suppressing a truth until you are convinced of the opposite of it, the opposite reality. So there's a realization of that revelation by every human being on the face of the earth. So that makes man responsible. General revelation makes man responsible to God in that everyone has a sense there has to be a true God. So it makes men responsible, and it's adequate based on this passage because man is under wrath. It's adequate for condemnation. Okay? But we would also say Paul's going to deal with this later. He's not dealing with it now. He's just showing that mankind stands condemned. But it's not adequate for salvation. General revelation is not adequate for salvation. And I'll expand upon that in a moment. So it's limited. General revelation is limited to the area of condemning all of humanity. Make sense? I know inside of us we're still thinking, well, what about the person that's never heard? Isn't that unfair? There's something not jiving here. Well, I'll get to that in a moment here. Special revelation is needed, the gospel message. That's why we send missionaries. That's why we print Bibles and send them all over the world. This is why we create pamphlets that explain the gospel message so that it goes out and that we try to get it to the edge of the earth, if you will, to the darkest parts of America, let's say. So special revelation, because there's only one way. It's only Jesus Christ. There's no other name under heaven whereby we may have salvation. What is that? Acts 4:12. So this leaves mankind, last part of verse 20, so that they are without excuse. Now the little phrase there, without excuse, is a translation of a word where we get the word for apologetics. Apologetics is giving a defense for Christianity, but in this context, there's going to be no one that is going to have a defense. No one is going to be able to say, I never heard of the one true God. I never received a revelation. Everyone is going to stand before a holy God, condemned on the basis of general revelation, without excuse, without an apologetic, without a defense. Stand naked before a holy God, and everyone is going to acknowledge, oh yes, when I was a child, I realized something inside of me, and I rejected that, and I went on and became an atheist, but I know there had to be a God. So they are without excuse. So we have Revelation, verse 19 and 20. We have responsibility of every human being. See the R's here? That's verse 20. They are without excuse. And there's lots of examples. What happens, I believe, to someone in the darkest of America? I think God draws people to himself, and he draws people to himself from all cultures, everywhere. And I think the first drawing is through general revelation and a realization there has to be a God. There has to be a creator that created all that I observe. And I've got a few examples that I've encountered. You may have encountered some. This is the story of most missionaries. When they go to lands that have never heard the gospel, they encounter people that report back to them that they knew that something inside of them told them that their animism, their idolatrous religious upbringing, that it just was not right. I encountered a man by the name of Ransford Sinibo several years ago, and that was the exact testimony that he gave. And he did not hear a missionary. He was from a very poor tribe, an animistic tribe that worshipped basically nature. And the government implemented a public school program, and they were poor, so he went half naked to school, but it was a privilege. And he went to school, and lo and behold, one of the textbooks that was used was the Bible, translated into their tribal language. He read that book, and he came to the realization. He knew inwardly. He said there was something that just nagged in me that I knew this animism wasn't good. It wasn't right. And he knew there has to be a big God, a God that created everything, a God that is mighty, an all-powerful God. And when he read the Bible, he realized that the creator God that's described in the Bible was that God. And he says he trusted in that God and trusted in Jesus Christ and became a believer. And I met him because he was going to Bible college here in the U.S. This was several years ago. You've heard the story of Helen Keller. What about those that are born blind? Those that are hearing impaired and have limited contact? Well, her story, remember Miss Sullivan was a believer and wanted to share the gospel with her and tried to figure out a way of communicating, and they did it basically by feeling. And after they developed a way of communicating, Miss Sullivan shared the gospel with Helen Keller, and Helen responded, I knew that God, I just didn't know his name. I just didn't know that it was Jesus Christ. And you know the rest of the story. A wonderful lady that was wonderfully converted. The lady on the slide there, I heard, her name's Grace, and she gave a testimony. She, and I'm trying to remember, I've lost my remembrance of the whole story, but she and a couple of other girls ministered to a tribe of people that had never had contact with the outside world. And they had the same experience. And for the sake of time, I won't tell you the story, but basically the same story as Ransford and many others that missionaries tell. And I believe that men are held accountable to the revelation they have. If they respond positively to that revelation, God's going to make sure that they get a pamphlet, that they get a Bible, that they get a missionary, that they get moved, or whatever it takes for those individuals that respond to that revelation, they respond positively. It's on God now, and I think God is going to make sure that person hears about Jesus Christ, because Christ is the only way. He is the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except by Him. So that's the answer, basically. What does mankind do with that? Verse 21. For even though they knew God, referring to everything he talked about, people in the darkest of America, darkest of South America, Africa, wherever, they knew God. Another word here for knowing. They knew him. God is known. He's revealed himself. And we have all these words. Apocalypto, that's verse 18, revelation there. God revealed himself. Known, gnostos, I showed you that one. Made things evident. We looked at that one in verse 19. Phanerao, all of these words emphasizing the knowing of God. They knew him. And now here in verse 20, clearly seen. And verse 21, understood. Noeo, another Greek word. Notice the variety and the differences. See the stress and the emphasis. Man is accountable. But man is not left by himself if he responds to what God has provided. And then to know, verse 21, ginosko. So that one is related to the one in verse 19, the second one there as well. That's the verbal word. All of these different words stressing knowing the real and the one true God. But what does mankind do? Also in verse 21, man rejects that revelation. And this is the general pattern. This is what man does. He suppresses that truth, puts God out of his thinking, puts him away from him, suppressing him. So they knew God. They did not honor him as God. This is the way of nations. This is the way of cultures. This is the way of the world. This is the way of mankind in general. This is the way of individuals. Did not honor him as God. In other words, nope, I don't believe in you. I'm going to suppress that until I believe that you don't even exist. Okay? Or give him thanks. They did not give him thanks. So we have a realization, a real understanding of that revelation, and that puts man responsible. But this text says that that revelation in general is rejected, and we'll see the next stage here, became futile in their speculations. So beginning with the middle part of verse 21, they rationalized it away. In other words, the reality, the truth that they suppressed, they rationalized it. And not only do they rationalize it, now they have to come up with a substitute, and we'll talk about that. So the result of that, rejecting of God, they replace God. And there's effects. There's things that happen in man's being or man's nature. They become futile in their speculations. So we lose clear thought. We lose the ability to discern right from wrong. And we begin to speculate and go off on all of these tangents. And we're affected by it. We become foolish. Their foolish heart is darkened. We become darkened. That revelation is no longer as clear as it was. This is why it's important to bring children into a saving relationship early. Because over time, we cover that up and suppress it to the point that their hearts become darkened. And now they're not receptive to truth. In fact, they can't see it. So people are affected intellectually, you might say. And this is where you find cultures. This is where you find peoples all over the world. This is what explains the world in which we live in. Their heart was darkened. Verse 22, professing to be wise, they became fools. Doesn't matter how many PhDs. In fact, people with PhDs oftentimes are so hardened to the gospel because their intellect has gone beyond the simplicity of salvation in Christ and Christ alone. So using an R here, not only do we have a realization or a real knowledge or understanding of revelation, we are accountable or responsible, the end of verse 20, But mankind, rather than responding in general, rejects that revelation. And he has to rationalize it away, and it affects him. There's a reprobation that occurs, or a change in his intellect and his attitude and his direction. So that's reprobation, became fools, became hardened. So it affects one. So if you're exposed to revelation, it's going to have an effect one way or another, either for the positive or for the negative. So we have man's lostness. He's spiritually dead, is what Paul says. Ephesians 2, 1 and 2. His heart is wicked. Who can understand it? Jeremiah, this description of the unbeliever. Jeremiah 17, 9. His mind is darkened in Ephesians 4, 17 and 18. Becomes physically evil, Ephesians 2, 3. His will, notice every aspect of mankind, his spirit, his heart, his mind, even his body, even his will is affected by rejecting revelation, Romans 3, 11. His conscience can be defiled. Every aspect of our humanity. This is depravity, man's lostness, Titus 1, 15. And Romans 1, 18 leaves man under wrath. If you take all of the several of the phrases, we're lost, that describe depravity, we're lost, we're blind, we're naked, we're helpless, we're unrighteous, we're evil, we're defiled, depraved, darkened, unable to respond, in bondage, under Satan's control, unable to understand, enemies of God, condemned, children of wrath, that's the unbeliever. So the gospel has to penetrate through all of that. That's why presenting the gospel is so difficult. But this is what an individual needs to realize. Maybe not to the depths of it, maybe not every aspect of it, but enough of it that he cries out for salvation in Jesus Christ. But that's not the end of the story. Verse 23, we don't live in a vacuum, even though we're affected by rejecting revelation. What do we do next? What does mankind do? We exchange the glory of the incorruptible God for an image. All mankind is idolatrous. We substitute other gods. Sometimes it's the God of me. I become the God of the universe. That's what the atheist actually ends up doing. He becomes the decider as to whether God exists or not, because he is now God. Exchange the glory of the incorruptible God for an image. We can add to our list here. We replace the one true God with something else. That's verse 23. And it comes in different forms. It can come in the form of corruptible man. The text makes that clear. And if you study the history of cultures, you can find there's idolatrous cultures. The Babylonians emphasized aspects of man, and some of their gods were in the form of man. And certainly the Greeks and the Romans, you can see the artwork. Their gods were pictured as supermen, you might say. Tibetan Buddhism as well, and others, Japanese cultures. It also takes the form of birds or animals and creatures, substitute. There's some African cultures there. Animism, they substitute animism for the one true God. Somewhere along the line in that culture, somebody began to worship trees or animals, etc. Historically, you can see the Egyptians focused on the eagle and other birds. The Romans as well. Other animals, Egyptians, they worshipped even insects. Hinduism has animal worship as well. Crawling creatures, Assyrians, Chaldeans, Egyptians, Africans, etc. That's the history of humanity, all humanity, no matter where. And we're going to bring this to a conclusion. You were wondering if we're going to make it. The rendering of God's wrath. That's verses 24 through 32. I don't have time to go into that, but I think you get the idea here, right? So man is under wrath, verse 18. God gives the reasons for that wrath, the main reason. Man rejects that revelation, and that has a cascading effect and accumulates other reasons as well, ending in idolatry, where we substitute idols for the one true God. And now beginning in verse 24, now we're going to see what Paul means by the wrath in the present tense. And what God does, and a display of the wrath of God, I think is summarized in three passages, and then he gives specific examples. I'm not going to be able to get into each of them, but I want you to notice the key phrase here. Therefore, okay, man has made his decision, his choice, his replacement. Now God is responding. This goes back to the wrath of God is, present tense, revealed from heaven. Therefore, this is how God displays that wrath. God gave them over. You might even translate it, God gave them up. God gives up on cultures. And the scary thing is, I'm hoping that God has not given up on our culture. But you can study historically, God destroys cultures in judgment eventually. And eventually is going to bring about final destruction and final wrath that is in the future. And he gives them over. The way you can see it is people become addicted to things, addictions. God has given them up. Now, there's still hope as long as they're breathing, but he allows them, okay, you want to go your own way. You want pleasure. You want these things. Go for it. And he lets them go and allows them to basically degrade themselves. So their bodies would be dishonored among them. And he talks about homosexuality. That's one of the end products of God giving up a culture. Notice 26, for this reason, almost the identical phrase here. For this reason, the reasons he's talked about, verses 18 through 23, for this reason, God gave him over to degrading passions. There's the homosexual, lesbian whole issue there. For their women exchange the natural function for that which is natural. Men, similarly in verse 27. And then again in verse 28. And then we have a long list of things that God gives people over. And it's just the depravity of cultures, depravity of mankind. Just as they did not see fit to acknowledge God any longer. In other words, they rejected that revelation and they substituted for other things. God says, go for it. You're on your own. This is going to end badly. You're going to see wrath. It's not going to be good. God gave them over to a depraved mind, to those things which are not proper. Then he gives a long list all the way to verse 32. So that's the depravity of mankind. And that's the answer. The answer, no matter where a person lives, no matter what time frame, God has revealed himself. But in general, man rejects that. And when man rejects that, let's put another R up here, if you will. We have realization of that revelation, 19 and 20, that puts us responsible before a holy God. And in general, we reject that revelation. And now we have to rationalize it away. That's verse 21 as well. And that causes effects upon us. We call that reprobation. Verse 23, we replace the one true God with an idol. And what do we have in verse 24 through 32? Somebody give me an R. There it is. You don't pronounce the W, do you? Wrath, 24 through 32. Another way of looking at this passage, Romans 18 through 32, the total passage, we have reasons for wrath, is because rejection of the revelation, which leads to rebellious reasoning, notice I'm using ours again here, that leads to ruinous religion, idolatry, and that ends in righteous rejection by God. There's your R. All have received, closing thought here, all have received an adequate revelation. And that revelation is intended that it give every man, no matter where he lives, an opportunity to seek the one true God. And there are some that do. There are few, far between. They're in a minority. But there are people in our culture, there's people that you know, that when you share the gospel, you can stir something within them. And it's the gospel that saves, not general revelation. General revelation holds them accountable, but that revelation is designed to draw them to the one true God.